What's happened to voting rights in America since the passage of the Voting Rights Act 50 years ago? Ari Berman will join us to talk about Give Us the Ballot, the Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America.
People know about Selma, they know about the marches, they know what led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act. But then the question is, what happened 50 years after that?
How do you weave China's sweeping history and contemporary culture into a novel about a Beijing taxi driver? Simon Winchester will tell us about Susan Barker's novel, The Incarnations.
This is a work of stunning imagination, and it tells the story of China in amazing, unforgettable detail.
And Paul Siegel has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Ari Berman is here to talk about his new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Welcome, Ari.
Thank you, Pamela.
So I think there's a perception that voting rights are a thing of the past. Is that what one of the things that you wanted to address with this book, that misperception?
Yeah, absolutely. So much of the civil rights history ends in 1965. People know about Selma, they know about the marches, they know what led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act. But then the question is, what happened 50 years after that? And that was really the question I wanted to answer. I wanted to go beyond the standard accounts of the civil rights movement and show both that the civil rights movement didn't end in 1965, and also debates over voting rights didn't end in 1965 either, that there was this fascinating 50-year period that really hadn't been explored.
Right. You take this all the way up to 2014 and new developments within the last year.
I tried to take it up as much to the present as possible while realizing that present circumstances had changed. But yeah, I really wanted to start my book where most accounts of the civil rights movement end. I wanted to start in Selma in 1965 and then as quickly as possible get beyond that and tell people the lesser known parts of the story and the battles that ensued in the decades after 1965.
All right, well, let's go back to 1965 for a second and even right before then and explain for people who know the Voting Rights Act by name but don't necessarily know, what is the Voting Rights Act? What did the law, the amendment stipulate?
Well, it's an interesting act because it essentially enforces the 15th Amendment, which was passed 95 years earlier and said the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And except for a brief, about 10-year period of Reconstruction, when the U.S. really forcefully enforced the 15th Amendment, we basically ignored it for 90 years. Mm-hmm. And that's why we had to pass a Voting Rights Act to enforce the 15th Amendment. And it did a few really critical things.
And so what did the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965 do?
It struck down literacy tests in the states with the longest history of voting discrimination and related tests like poll taxes, grandfather clauses, etc.
What are some examples of one of those practices?
Well, like the most famous example would be the literacy test that black voters faced in Selma, Alabama, where you had to name 67 county judges.
And this test was not given to white voters.
That's the problem with the test is it was designed so that there was a ton of discretion for the local white segregations registrar. So white voters never faced the same questions as black voters. And even if black voters were somehow able to name 67 county judges in Alabama, which no one in Alabama, not even the judges themselves, could do, they still would likely fail the test because the registrar would find some problem. So there was a lot of discretion given to these Southern registrars, and they did everything they could to make sure that black voters were not able to register in places like Alabama and Mississippi. The Voting Rights Act sent federal officials down south to actually register black voters, and this was a transformative undertaking. You had in places like Alabama, there had been no black voters registered for decades.
And so it didn't just pass the law, it enforced
it. It enforced it. And that's what was so critical about the Voting Rights Act is you had hundreds and then thousands and then eventually millions of people registered because of the law. And then federal officials stayed in the South to make sure that elections weren't stolen after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And then over a longer period of time, what the Voting Rights Act did is it said to those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination, places like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, they had to approve their voting changes with the federal government to prevent future discrimination. And that made the Voting Rights Act more powerful than any other civil rights law. The fact that you could preemptively stop discrimination was a very powerful and revolutionary thing.
So that all sounds like a very happy ending. What went wrong after that?
The problem is that opponents of the VRA challenged it from its inception and kept finding creative ways to do it. So first they challenged the constitutionality.
And who's the they?
Well, at first it was traditional Southern conservatives, people like George Wallace in Alabama, and they challenged the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act immediately after it passed. And the Supreme Court in an 8-1 decision said that the Voting Rights Act was constitutional and that the federal government did have the power to regulate state voting changes. That's exactly why the Voting Rights Act was passed.
And that decision was when?
Okay, it was on the one-year anniversary of Bloody Sunday, so March 7th, 1966.
Okay, and then what happened after that? Because this went back to the court again.
Yeah, so what happened after that is states like Mississippi began changing their election laws to make it harder for these newly registered black voters to be able to run for office and win. So they would gerrymander political districts so that black candidates wouldn't be elected, or they would switch from district elections to countywide elections so that in places where there was a white majority, the white majority could elect all the candidates. Or they would have candidates be elected from multiple districts. So let's say a district was 60% white and 40% African American. Those 60% whites could elect every single candidate. So basically the idea was narrow and limit and basically make it impossible for black candidates to be elected in the years after the Voting Rights Act. And this led to a much broader battle of representation that lasted for decades. And that became the next fight over the Voting Rights Act.
I want to go back to the Supreme Court, but for a second, stay with this, the redistricting. Tell us about what Lee Atwater did during George H.W. Bush's election in 1988.
So it's really interesting because in the decades after the Voting Rights Act, there is still a dramatic underrepresentation of African Americans in the South. You have a situation in the 1980s, for example, African Americans make up 25% of the South's population, but only 5% of elected seats. And so black Democrats in particular are trying to figure out a way that they can get more representation. White Republicans, who are also underrepresented in the South, because white Democrats still largely control the South, even up to the 1980s, white Republicans are also trying to figure out a way to gain more representation. So they decide that they are going to join forces with black Democrats to create what are known as majority-minority districts. So you draw a district that's, let's say, 60 or 70% African American, and that allows an African American candidate to get elected. What happens is that black Democrats are siphoned away from white Democratic districts and given to black Democrats. That means the surrounding districts become a lot more white and conservative. So what happens particularly in the early 1990s is that you see a dramatic increase in black Democrats being elected to Congress from the South, and you also see a dramatic increase in white Republicans being elected in the South. And this was both a natural extension of the Voting Rights Act and also an unintended consequence, and something I think that LBJ was afraid that the act would help Republicans. I don't think he initially foresaw Republicans adopting precisely this strategy, but it was true that in the drawing of these districts, Republicans did benefit.
Let's return to the Supreme Court, because one of your arguments is that that the Supreme Court has been responsible for a lot of the dismantling of the VRA. So 1966, the Supreme Court affirms the VRA. What happens with Nixon's election in 68?
Well, Nixon begins to appoint conservative justices who shift the court to the right. He appoints four justices, and they range from people who are on the center right to people who are on the far right.
Who are those justices?
Warren Burger was appointed to replace Earl Warren, the great liberal chief justice. So that shifted the court to the right. And then he appointed Harry Blackmun, Lewis Powell, and William Rehnquist. And Rehnquist was the most influential because he was by far the most conservative, particularly on civil rights issues, and he would later become Chief Justice. And so he was known as the Lone Ranger when Nixon appointed him because he was so conservative and out there. He said, for example, that Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided. There was accusations that he had administered literacy tests to black and Hispanic voters when he was a Republican Party official in Arizona. So this was someone who was very much on the fringe of the Republican Party, but then would become the future leader of the Supreme Court.
The White House and Congress have both gone on to expand, confirm, reaffirm the importance of the Voting Rights Act. What has happened in the last 30 years, 40 years with in the Supreme Court when the VRA has come before?
Well, the Supreme Court had largely upheld the Voting Rights Act through the years. They limited the Voting Rights Act for the first time in 1980, saying that you had to show intentional discrimination to strike down a potentially discriminatory election system. But then they were overruled by the Congress. And then largely up to recently, the Supreme Court had been a body that had expanded or upheld the power of the VRA. And so it's only really in fairly recent times, I'd say beginning in the 1990s, but culminating in the current Roberts Court, that the Supreme Court has been viewed more as an opponent of voting rights than someone that has historically protected voting rights.
A lot of this comes down to two very different interpretations of the VRA. What are those two competing visions?
Well, there has been a critique of the Voting Rights Act in conservative circles that basically the VRA was well-intended, that it was supposed to knock down things like literacy tests, but it should have only applied to voter registration. So essentially, once black voters and other minorities were able to register in large numbers, there shouldn't have been a Voting Rights Act.
So a very narrow interpretation.
A very narrow interpretation. I think that is one that is shared by Chief Justice Roberts. The other interpretation, which is the one that the Supreme Court endorsed in 1969, was that the Voting Rights Act governed everything that would make a vote effective. So it wasn't just about the right to vote. It was about the power of the vote, that Congress passed this not just to allow people to register, but to have a real say in their political lives, to have a real representation. And so when Chief Justice Earl Warren in 1969 endorsed the idea that it governed everything to make the vote effective, that dramatically expanded the power of the VRA.
So not just about who's voting, but also about who's being elected.
Absolutely. That it was about not just the right to vote, but about political representation.
You talk about a few specific counter-revolutionaries, and one of them we've mentioned a couple of times is Chief Justice John Roberts. Tell us about Roberts' position on the VRA and what he's done.
Well, he's such an important counter-revolutionary because he came of age in the Reagan era. He clerked for Justice Rehnquist, who we talked about earlier, who was the most conservative justice on the court in the 1980s on voting rights. And then he worked in the Reagan Justice Department in the early 1980s, where he really sought to limit the power of the Voting Rights Act. He argued that the Voting Rights Act should only apply to instances of intentional discrimination, which would have dramatically narrowed its power. He said that it would lead to affirmative action in the electoral sphere. And then 30 years later, when he's put on the court, we see that he leads the effort to gut the Voting Rights Act. He takes away the protection that says that those states with the worst histories of discrimination have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. What we see when he's on the court, both in a 2009 case and then a 2013 case.
He basically takes away federal oversight of the implementation. Okay.
Yes. We see that in 2009 and in 2013, Justice Roberts remains very hostile to the Voting Rights Act. And so I would say he's probably the most prominent critic of the VRA, and he also happens to be one of the most powerful people in America.
What happened with that decision, the June 25th, 2013 decision?
Well, what happened is that the Supreme Court struck down the formula that determined which states had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. What that meant is that most of the states of the old Confederacy and then also some other states no longer had to approve their voting changes. And that meant that laws that were blocked previously, like Texas's voter ID law, were allowed to go into effect. It also meant that new states would pass new voting restrictions that were tougher than previously considered, and they didn't have to get federal approval anymore. So what we see is a month after that Supreme Court decision, North Carolina passes this sweeping restructuring of its election system that basically either repeals or curtails every voting reform in that state that had encouraged people to vote. And that was a dramatic response to the Supreme Court's decision that really surprised a lot of people. And so what you had is in the 2014 election, which was the first election without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, we saw thousands of people who were disenfranchised in places like Texas and North Carolina on a scale that we hadn't seen previously.
What have the results been?
The results have been that voters have been turned away from the polls by these new restrictions in places like Texas and North Carolina, that it's become more difficult to challenge these voting changes. The burden of proof is now on the plaintiffs, so those who are facing discrimination, to actually have to prove discrimination. The Voting Rights Act hasn't been totally dismantled, but it's been badly weakened. So you look at Texas, for example. Texas's strict voter ID law was struck down in 2012. Then after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, it went into effect. Now it's still being challenged, and it was just struck down again by a court of appeals 3 years after it was initially blocked. And one of the things that the Voting Rights Act was supposed to do was end this torturous process of litigation. Justice Department lawyers before 1965 spent 28 months on the average case, and they reviewed 36,000 pages of voter registration records. And now you look at the Texas case, it's already gone over 28 months. So these cases are just very expensive and very difficult to litigate, and they're tough to win now.
All right. Well, as if we needed more proof in 2014 that the civil rights movement is still needed. Ari, this is a very strongly argued history. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
The book again is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America by Ari Berman, reviewed this week in the book review by Jeffrey Rosen. Simon Winchester joins us now. He is the author of many books. His latest one, Pacific, will be out in October. But for now, he reviews in this week's issue a new novel by Susan Barker, The Incarnations. Welcome, Simon.
Well, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about this book.
It is a quite extraordinary book, published in London earlier this year, to rave reviews. It is a remarkable story. Simple at first, about a rather miserable, unfortunate Beijing taxi driver called Wang Jun, who one day, as he's driving a fare from somewhere in that polluted city to somewhere else, finds in the visor above his seat a letter. And it's a letter, the first of many, from an unknown previous incarnation of the driver himself, who tells him stories about himself and incarnations of himself through various periods of Chinese history. So embedded within the day-to-day life of this miserable, unfortunate taxi driver are extraordinary episodes from Chinese history. And this is a work of stunning imagination. And it tells the story of China through these vignettes of the past 1,000 years in amazing, unforgettable detail.
So these are previous lives.
They're previous lives in various dynasties when extraordinary things happen to this man, whether they're in the Jin dynasty, when, let's say, the Mongols were invading China, or when they're at the most decadent height of the Ming dynasty, this extraordinary emperor Jiajing, or in more recent times during the Cultural Revolution. In all of the periods, terrible things happened. I mean, this is a deeply disturbing book. It's beautifully written and it's memorable, but it paints a pretty horrific portrait of China through the centuries.
The letters are signed from a soulmate?
A soulmate, yes. I mean, he is never entirely sure who that soulmate is, and I'm not going to ruin the reader's suspense by discovering who it is. But yes, a soulmate, I mean, someone who appears to be watching him through the very complicated life he's living anyway, with disappointments and stay in a mental hospital and various affairs that his wife is having and all sorts of gruesome quotidian details of his life, there is this watcher in the background. And the watcher is offering him these letters and telling him stories from the soulmate's perspective of his life in the millennia beforehand. It's a very unsettling book.
It's an incredibly ambitious book, too, because she covers 1,000 years of history.
She does. Susan Barker is English-Chinese living in London, but she went off this is her third novel, and she went off to Beijing for 5 years and traveled all over the city to get to know it incredibly well and read up on Chinese history, with which, you know, being half Chinese, she was at least moderately familiar. But I do have some concern about the book. I mean, it is wonderful. I mean, it is memorable. As someone compared it to saying it's a Chinese version, as it were, of Midnight's Children, as vivid a description of China as Salman Rushdie described India at the coming to independence. But the portrait it paints of China, not just today, but in the past, is so unremittingly bleak and full of such horror and decadence that I think that it could conceivably, considering the politics of the present day, particularly the coming, what many people believe is the coming confrontation between the United States and China, it plays into the hands of those people who are afraid of, to use an old phrase now, the yellow peril.
Right.
Because there's little that's positive about China. You'd read this and think, oh my God, these people are becoming more powerful. I am terrified.
There's a quote in your review. I would argue, you write, that Barker's novel brilliantly illuminates some of the defining episodes in the nation's long, long story, at least as vividly as any of the textbooks available in our schools, but perhaps more dangerously, too. I'm assuming that caveat is about that sort of leaning towards the idea of a yellow peril.
Yes. I mean, the notable thing about the book is that she ticks off, almost in a perfunctory way, the way stations that we in the West think of recently important, you know, things like Tiananmen Square, things like that gigantic earthquake in Tangshan that killed, what, 250,000 people in 1975, the death of Mao. These are all sort of almost, as I say, ticked off in a perfunctory manner, because the big episodes, the Ming Dynasty, the coming of the Mongols, the rise of the Manchus. That's what China remembers. China looks at everything in the long term. And these little things, I mean, we don't think of Tiananmen Square as being a little thing at all, but to the Chinese, the rulers of China, it's dismissive. It's just a little episode. And she very much plays into that. And so this is a story of the big episodes in Chinese history, of which the coming anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the state, which will be in 2049, that's seen in China as a big moment that everyone is preparing for, because by then the Chinese intend to have a hammerlock on the whole world.
And America, we just don't even bother thinking about 2049 yet.
Well, everything here is on the four-year cycle, and yet the Chinese are prepared. I mean, I've been studying a reasonable amount recently about the Chinese and the American navies. The Americans, you know, terribly upset about day-to-day incidents in the Western Pacific, but the Chinese are planning things and strategies for 20, 30, 40 years ahead, and putting the Americans, us, on the back foot all the time. And this ability to think in the long term, because they're such an ancient culture, as this book so brilliantly reminds us, is something that we need to be wary of.
For short-term thought Americans looking at this book, how much do you have to know about ancient Chinese history? I think most Americans know about Mao and the Cultural Revolution and obviously Tiananmen. But how well-versed do you need to be in ancient Chinese history to appreciate the novel?
That's a wonderful question. And I think probably you do have to be reasonably well-versed. I mean, for instance, there's confrontations in the 14th century in this book between the Mongols and the Jurchens. Now, to know that the Jurchens are the Manchus, you need to know something about Chinese history, and that's not explained. And so there are some assumptions that this book is for a relatively educated about China, that is, audience. And I think that is going to somewhat limit its appeal. Having said that, though, the descriptive power of Susan Barker when she comes to, for instance, the life and the incredible amount of eroticism in this book of, let's say, the decadence in the Ming Dynasty 400 years later, is so powerful that you sort of don't care about the little details that, had you been better educated in China, you might understand. So, yes, you do. If you know Chinese history, this is an even richer experience. If you don't, you'll get through it quite easily.
Well, you've hooked in readers with the mention of the eroticism, and perhaps now I will deflect those interested readers with this. But you mentioned that one of her influences is Georges Perec, who's often thought of as incredibly impenetrable. But in what ways does he influence her writing that you could receive?
Yes. Well, I mean, to be perfectly honest, my favorite book is Life of a User's Manual. It's a book I have everywhere with me. And it's so full, to my mind anyway, of these astonishing, it's called a Life of User's Manual because really all life is in this 600, 700 page book written in the mid 1980s. And it's full of lists of things that humankind does in various aspects of the life in France that Georges Perec describes. She does the same thing. The lists she gives us of things that are sort of commonplace in, let's say, the Ming Dynasty court are so comprehensive and so bizarre. When you read about the food they were eating or the sexual practices they indulge in, you're overwhelmed with the richness that Perec was so brilliant at describing. So I'm completely won over. Any fan of that writer, the man who so famously wrote the book A Void without using the letter E throughout, it was a great sort of literary gymnast, I think they're going to like Susan Barker as well.
All right. Well, we'll leave it on that enticing note. Simon Winchester, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Simon Winchester reviews this week the new novel by Susan Barker, The Incarnations.
This is John Williams, an editor at The Times, and I'm here with Parul Sehgal, who has bestseller news. Hey, Parul.
Hey, John.
So what's new on the list this week?
You know, not much. There are three new books on the fiction bestseller list, all familiar names. There's Friction by Sandra Brown, The Murderer's Daughter by Jonathan Kellerman, and The Last Bus to Wisdom by Ivan Doig, and all sort of like good kind of good, like, middle or end of the summer thrillers, and there's nothing new on nonfiction. But as I was putting together the column in Greg's absence, mm-hmm. I noticed, and this is kind of exciting, at number 18 on the extended hardcover bestseller list in fiction is a book called Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin.
Yes.
And this is, I mean, it's exciting because it's a book of short stories posthumously published. Berlin died in 2004, I think. So, I mean, there's that element, but there's also sort of the excitement of finding in her, as I found when I was sort of looking through the book and trying to figure out what to do for the column, mm-hmm. a voice that feels so fresh and so exciting. And you yeah. actually wrote a profile of Berlin. And I want to tell me a little bit about her voice as you found it.
Yeah, well, I wrote about her and talked to some people who had known her when she was alive. Like you said, she died more than a decade ago. So unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to talk to her. But yeah, FSG put out this collection, and I feel like the voice is very fresh. Sometimes when people sort of rescue something from obscurity, mm-hmm. you can feel a bit like it's a homework assignment.
Right.
And even if it ends up being good or tasty vegetables, it feels like you're supposed to eat them
yeah.
for your health.
Yeah.
This is really the opposite of that. I feel like
Isn't
anyone
it?
Who – and it's both nice that it's on the list but not totally shocking to me, because I feel like people are passing word along because they get excited about these stories, because they do feel like they're meeting someone new who they haven't heard from before and who they really are enthusiastic about. It's not just –
Well, yeah, but like, okay, so like we had your profile and there were two very positive reviews. There's Dwight Garner's review in The Daily mm-hmm. and Ruth Franklin's review in The Book Review. And it's still one of those books that I think if I'd seen all this coverage, I would still be pressing on people, being like, this is so much funnier and coarser mm-hmm. and warmer than you think, right? But at the same time, it feels like in this weird American way, like it kind of feels like a predecessor to certain kinds of like Tina Fey jokes. You know, it feels fresh and it feels sort of like topical and like...
Yeah, I haven't heard the Tina Fey comparison, but she's very
funny.
You
heard it here.
Yeah, we heard it here first. But I think that that's
true. And
the
life was sad though, right? Like the life was difficult.
Her life was difficult. Well, she battled alcoholism for a long time, and I think she was abused when she was younger by family members when she was growing up. And so, but there are clips of her speaking actually that you can find out there. I think one of them is maybe linked to in the profile that I wrote a couple of weeks back, where you just can tell how full of life she was.
Right.
So I think even though life was difficult, people talked about her as if, you know, everyone called her very generous and warm and caring. And I think everyone was rooting for her to get better, and she eventually stopped drinking. She raised four sons, and she managed to write these stories while working a lot of different kinds of odd jobs and the kinds of things that we don't think of, you know, very successful writers as having to do. And yet, yeah, I think these stories place her very much in the vein of people like Laurie Moore, Dennis Johnson, and yet they're completely themselves. I mean, her life was so unique, and the stories are very autobiographical, and so it would be very difficult for anyone to try to imitate this.
Yeah.
They're set in the West.
Yeah.
They have to do with life, live very much on the margins, and the gallows humor is very unique. I don't think many people would be able to find the humor in these situations that she does.
Yeah,
it feels like a new American writer has been discovered, even though she was sort of there all along. We'll see if she can get further than the extended list. It's exciting.
Hope so. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pearl.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.